Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Steve Rendell of the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who examines how U.S. media has covered the unfolding story of the Bush administration's use of disinformation to justify their war on Iraq. Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way, who takes a critical look at the White House nomination of William Pryor to the federal bench and the questions about his participation in a scheme to solicit campaign contributions from companies he regulates as Alabama's Attorney General. And Jared Bernstein with the Economic Policy Institute, who discusses the Bush administration's push to rewrite regulations that could deprive millions of workers their overtime pay. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The BBC reports that Pakistani national Mohammad Sagir, who was released from detention from Guantanamo Bay last November, is filing a $10.4 million lawsuit against the Bush administration. Attorney Mohammad Ikram Chaudhry, who is representing Sagir, says the former enemy combatant suffered from mental and physical distress while in captivity. Sagir claims he was placed into solitary confinement by the U.S. military and further alleged that he was given alcohol-laced drinks, contrary to the practice of Islam. Attorney Chaudhry told the BBC World Today program that the conditions that Sagir experienced have had a negative impact on his health. Sagir, who is from Koha, Afghanistan, was on a preaching mission in the northern part of the country when he was arrested by Afghan warlord General Rashid Dostum and handed over to U.S. authorities. The former prisoner claims that the American military deprived him of food, forbade him to pray, and forced him to shave off his beard. Before French peacekeepers arrived in June, the daily horror began by noon in the war-torn hamlet of Bunia, part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. That's when child soldiers carrying Kalashnikov rifles started prowling the streets, terrorizing the local population. Neighborhood missionary Jan Mohl stated these children who kill, loot, and obey the rule of violence are often drunk, and some are as young as 7 years old. The government-backed adolescent soldiers are known as the Union of Congolese Patriots and arrived in May after Ugandan soldiers retreated as part of a Congo peace treaty. They belong to the Hema tribe and have driven out forces loyal to the Lendu tribe, who had fought on behalf of Uganda. An estimated 3 million people have died in the Congo since war engulfed the nation 4 years ago. According to the World Press Review magazine, over 1 million more people in the Ituri region, that includes Bunia, have been forced to leave their homes in recent years. A report by Human Rights Watch issued in early June found that 5,000 people in Ituri were killed in the last year, targeted because of their ethnicity. For now, aid workers predict more looting, killing, and masses of refugees once the French peacekeepers leave. It is a scenario that too often has been repeated in Congo's bloody past. Rupert Murdoch is on the verge of rapidly expanding his global media empire. The right-wing media mogul is in the final stages of winning control of DirecTV, America's biggest direct broadcast satellite service that will allow Fox-like programming to be beamed into homes across the nation. Besides running DirecTV, Murdoch will own the assets of Hughes Electronics, the parent company of the satellite firm. This will put Murdoch in position to dominate Latin American media and be a global player in broadband and video services. With the addition of DirecTV, Murdoch will own the major direct broadcast satellite systems in the U.S., Europe, Asia, and Latin America. As The Nation magazine observed, Murdoch will become the Republicans' own in-house Citizen Kane. So far, the only opposition to Murdoch's deal is coming from a few competing media companies, such as Cox, Advance Newhouse, and affiliates of the National Association of Broadcasters. Unions, which will own 20% of the stock of the new Murdoch company, have not protested the merger to government agencies, nor have media reformers put the spotlight on Murdoch's new media grab. The future of the world's digital media platform and the nature of open access to television could hang in the balance. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
16 words in President Bush's State of the Union address last January 28th, quote, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa, end quote, are becoming as well known as the 18-minute gap in former President Nixon's White House tape made famous in the Watergate scandal. Whether the latest questions on Bush's Iraq policy will lead down the path of impeachment or resignation is far from clear. One critical element in the evolution of the Watergate scandal was the lead role of the mainstream press, some of whose reporters pursued the story with dogged determination and provided the public with critical details about the lies and cover-up coming from the White House. But the U.S. media has undergone dramatic changes over the past three decades, with just a handful of conglomerates now controlling virtually all television networks, radio stations, newspapers, and magazines. Instead of journalism being the primary mission in many newsrooms, profit for shareholders is now the bottom line. In the current media climate, very few corporate reporters are willing to ask the tough questions that helped topple a president. Over the last few weeks, the press has, however, focused on the Africa uranium story in great detail. In an interview recorded on July 14th, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Steve Randell, senior analyst with the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, about what the media should be looking at in this unfolding scandal.
Well, it's sort of a good news, bad news thing. The good news is that we're seeing good, hard-hitting, critical reporting. We're hearing reporters in mainstream corporate media asking tough questions of the White House in a way that we really haven't seen going back into the 70s during the Watergate time. However, if you just focus on the Niger uranium hoax, you miss the wider, the bigger picture. The pattern of deception that has gone on as far as the White House is concerned. You miss this sort of history going back months and months of the White House stretching evidence about weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear, chemical, biological, and missiles. And I would also add to that the so-called link between Saddam Hussein or Baghdad and Al-Qaeda. So this is a pattern of deception that should be being covered as a pattern and not just as one issue. Back in September and October, the Bush and the Blair governments pointed to several sites, several locations in Iraq, 13 to be exact, the so-called 13 sites of concern that both the Bush and the Blair government claimed there were activities taking place in these 13 sites that were proof, positive, that the Hussein regime was reconstituting its nuclear, its biological, and its banned missile programs. Now remember, this was October and September of last year in 2002. The UNMOVIC UN weapons inspectors returned to Iraq. I don't think the Bush and Blair governments knew that the inspectors would be back in Iraq as early as a month or two later in November. And when they got there, they went straight to these 13 sites. And guess what? They found nothing. They found nothing in these sites. Now, that's a very interesting story. It's a very interesting story that most U.S. citizens don't know about. This was in November this came out, so it was still 3 months before Colin Powell's famous presentation at the UN Security Council. I would submit that if the media had played up the failure in the case of those 13 sites of concern, that the context surrounding Secretary of State Colin Powell at the UN Security Council should have been a lot different. Instead of going in there as the big mega star, the big diplomat, and coming out and receiving gushing reviews from the press. The press couldn't get enough of him. He was so convincing, Andrea Mitchell said on NBC. I think there may have been some tougher scrutiny of Colin Powell's presentation there, which, by the way, I think the media should be looking at very carefully now. Let's remember, he pointed his finger at mobile weapons labs that British intelligence is now saying were not weapons labs, as they're confirming more or less what Scott Ritter has been saying all along, that those tractor-trailer units are really for producing helium for weather balloons that are used by artillery so that they can gauge the speed of winds and weather. In another case, Colin Powell held up pictures. They were not photographs. They were drawings of so-called drones, unmanned gliders, that some in the administration suggested were going to make it all the way from Iraq to the U.S. and were going to somehow wreak some weapons of mass destruction terror on us. Well, they found those gliders, and those gliders have a range of 5 miles. They're like overgrown children's remote control airplanes. The operator has to be within eyesight of these drones in order to operate them, and certainly they couldn't get very far from the borderline of Iraq. So far, there's been nothing turned up that comes close to approaching, one, either the biological weapons labs that Colin Powell suggested were there, or these deadly long-distance gliders.
What do you think is the appropriate response from the media to other claims, current claims that maybe aren't directly, may or may not be directly related to Iraq? For example, last week there was a report of Iranian military moving across the border into Iraq. As far as what I heard, there was no real explanation for where they got that information. It was more like an assertion from the government. And, you know, after what's been going on with the information about Iraq, it makes me wonder, at least, well, where is that coming from and how accurate is it?
Well, people should not only be skeptical of everything that comes out of the administration, but also everything that comes out of our mainstream news media and alternative media. People should be skeptical in general. They should draw from a broad variety of sources, and they should make up their own mind.
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Call FAIR at area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. Since coming to office, the Bush administration has put forward a long list of staunchly conservative nominees for the federal bench. The Democrats in the U.S. Senate, where confirmation hearings are conducted, have approved 133 of the White House nominees and employed the filibuster to block two individuals for what they consider extremist judicial views. But a wider controversy has now erupted around the nomination of Alabama State Attorney General William Pryor, Jr. to the Federal Appeals Court for the 11th Circuit. His rigid opposition to abortion, civil rights, and individual liberties made it likely that Senate Democrats might once again filibuster the nomination. But documents provided to the Judiciary Committee shortly before a scheduled vote on the nominee reveal that Pryor may have lied in previous testimony regarding his participation in a scheme by GOP attorney generals to seek campaign contributions from companies they regulate. The Republican Attorneys General Association, or RAGA, had successfully solicited hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign cash from corporations in 6 states, which were then sent to the Republican National Committee without a payment. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas, who as a former attorney general participated in RAGA fundraising himself, accused the former employee who leaked the documents of stealing evidence and threatened legal action against her. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director with People for the American Way, who examines the prior nomination and the serious ethical issues involved in a system where political payoffs were solicited from potential targets of investigation.
It's hard to say who is the worst Bush judicial nominee, but if there is a single one, Pryor may be it. Pryor has expressed an extreme far-right view that is frankly to the right even of people like Scalia and Thomas on the Supreme Court. He has pushed for a so-called states' rights agenda that would make it impossible to protect people against the states that has been rejected even unanimously by the Supreme Court. For example, cases involving the privacy of drivers or the ability to sue counties if counties violate people's rights. He's called Roe versus Wade the worst abomination of constitutional law. He's has an awful record on environmental issues, on civil rights issues. Issue after issue, he has staked out an extreme far-right position that would move the courts backwards on just about every issue of concern to Americans. In addition, there have been some serious ethical issues raised relating to his creation in many ways of a soft money group called RAGA, the Republican Attorney General's Association, to solicit funds from businesses who are regulated by attorneys general that has now gotten in some additional trouble with the answers he gave to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Specifically, what are the Democrats planning in terms of filibuster or otherwise trying to block this nomination, and where is the process right now?
Well, right now, the process is that he has had a hearing. and a vote is currently scheduled on him, at least tentatively. But as I was mentioning before, there's been an ethical issue that's come up that has created some serious problems. Pryor was asked about this Raga group, which he helped to create, and which solicits money for the Republican National Committee from the very businesses that attorneys general are involved in regulating. A number of his colleagues, Republican attorneys general, have declined to join it or have criticized it because of the obvious conflict between an attorney general putting his hand out for money from a business that the attorney general may then be in charge of suing or regulating. He was asked about this at his hearing and said that as far as he knew, there were no solicitations that occurred that he was involved in of businesses in Alabama or tobacco companies, because he's been well known for opposing the tobacco suits. And it's turned out after the hearing that there are documents and witnesses that suggest that Mr. Pryor may not have been telling the full truth to the committee, which the Democrats are now insisting, quite rightly, as the Republicans clearly would if the shoe were on the other foot, that that this be fully investigated before a vote occurs.
Now, as you said, the Republican Attorneys General Association, or RAGA, as it's known, has regularly sought contributions from the companies that these attorney generals in six states regulate. And companies I hear mentioned who are approached for contributions include insurance companies and tobacco companies. Could you give us some examples of the quid pro quo that may have been going on in terms of these contributions and the access that it purchased?
Well, again, part of the problem is that nobody knows too much about that, because one of the things that's also been criticized about RAGA is that since the money goes to the Republican National Committee generally, there aren't records that are publicly kept about which corporations have given specifically to the attorneys general. But from the information that has come out so far, there do seem to be a number of very troubling examples. One of the other attorneys general who helped found RAGA, John Cornyn, who is now a U.S. Senator from Texas, allegedly made solicitations directly to Shell Oil Company. Well, Shell Oil had a regulatory matter pending in Texas that got resolved in their favor. And just today, the Houston Chronicle very severely criticized Cornyn for being involved in that, saying he ought to come clean on exactly what happened, because people could easily contend that Shell Oil got more favorable treatment because of this. There is some evidence, apparently, that Brown & Williamson, the big tobacco company, gave money through RAGA, perhaps to Mr. Pryor himself. And as I said before, Pryor is known for attempts to go a lot easier on the tobacco companies than other attorneys general have done. Again, more investigating is going on this right now, but the whole idea of regulated companies giving to attorneys general raised so many questions that there are a number of Republican attorneys general that have severely criticized the whole idea, saying, frankly, we don't think we should be doing this. Pryor, when he created this, was really quite explicit in saying, we need corporations to help us elect Republican attorneys general like me who will be friends of business. Practically an explicit invitation in a lot of very troubling ways. And I think, again, Democrats were quite concerned about that at the hearing and now are even more concerned because there are serious allegations that Pryor may have misled the committee about his own involvement with it.
That was Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director of People for the American Way. To contact the group, call area code 202-467-4999. Or visit their website at www.pfaw.org. Backing of powerful corporate lobbyists, the Bush administration is successfully pushing to change federal work regulations that could deprive over 8 million white-collar employees of overtime pay when they work more than a 40-hour week. The Labor Department has proposed new regulations that would give employers the right to reclassify workers from hourly wage earners to administrative or executive status, thus depriving them of the right to earn time and a half pay for overtime hours. These changes to labor guidelines that have been on the books for over 50 years, with downgrade standards now governing the educational background and supervisory authority necessary to exempt employees from overtime pay requirements. Some economists have predicted that if enacted, these revisions would force increasing numbers of companies to shuffle job titles in order to remain competitive by paying workers less. The Republican-controlled House recently approved the measure by a narrow 213-210 margin, while the Senate has not as yet scheduled a vote. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jared Bernstein, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, who discusses the Bush administration's drive to change these labor regulations and the consequences for millions of lower-paid workers.
The work rules are part of the Fair Labor Standards Act. This is a law that was enacted in the late 1930s, kind of in the midst of the Depression. At that time, Congress and the Roosevelt administration realized that workers, especially workers at the lower end of the labor market who didn't have a lot of bargaining clout, were often exploited by employers and forced to work overtime without pay. So it established a rule that certain groups of workers would get time and a half, that is, would be paid their hourly rate plus 50% more for working an hour of overtime. The Bush administration has proposed a new set of rules that we believe, in fact, we're quite certain, will exempt millions of workers from overtime protection. Not all workers who are currently covered will be exempted by the new rules. In fact, it's a minority of workers. But it's enough that I think it'll make a real unfortunate difference in the lives of those affected.
This proposed change won passage in the House, but what happens next?
It's an interesting regulation because it's not legislative. I mean, this is a little bit intricate, but it's worth understanding. There are different types of rules that the government passes. There's legislation which has to be passed by both houses of Congress and then signed by the president. But then there's regulations. A regulation is a rule under the purview of the administration. And this is an example of that type of rule. The administration themselves unilaterally can decide to change this rule. What Congress voted on was whether or not to fund the proposed regulations. That is, Congress can say, go ahead and change the rule. We're not going to give you the money you need to implement it. Congress failed to block the rule by not taking that tack. You know, the Senate will then take it up, and it almost doesn't really matter that much because given the way Republicans dominate Capitol Hill these days, even if the Senate votes against the rule, once the two bodies get together and have a conference and figure out what they're going to do, it's very likely that the administration will prevail. They've just got too much clout up there on Capitol Hill right now.
Now, there are a lot of people in this country that I'm sure are not aware of these rules changes that would affect them very seriously in terms of their weekly, monthly, and annual income. What is the impact, and why don't we know more about this work rule change?
The piece that myself and colleagues wrote, and a lot of work by some of the labor unions who are trying to protect this important rule, did actually gain some traction in the press over the last few weeks, and there was a flurry of interest. But as I said, the administration is very likely to shove this through anyway. What we're talking about here are a set of rules that determine how employers classify workers vis-a-vis this Fair Labor Standards Act. So, for example, if someone is a manager or a highly skilled worker, what the rule designates as a so-called learned professional, that's someone who clearly has supervisory responsibility and they're doing a job that is typically pretty advanced in nature, that person is going to be exempt from overtime under the current rules. That's a salaried worker. Somebody like me in my job, and I work as an economist, if I work overtime, if I work more than an 8-hour day or more than a 40-hour week, that's just the way it is. Most salaried workers face that kind of situation in the workplace. You get an annual salary, you get your job done, whether you have to work overtime, so be it. But for hourly workers, workers who are, say, working in, say, the retail industry or fast foods or in the health services, when they work an hour of overtime, they're classified as workers who are protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act, by the overtime rules, they're eligible for time and a half. Under the rule changes, many of these workers face being reclassified. They're currently hourly workers, but their employers will be able to say to them, under these new rules, you are now a salaried worker, you're a professional, you are not eligible for overtime. Let me give you an example. I think that might help. Imagine someone who's a dental hygienist. Now, a dental hygienist typically has a few years of training beyond high school, but they would not classify under the current rules as a professional. Their training is such that they tend to be hourly paid workers who are eligible for overtime. Under the new rules, they could be classified as professional based on their experience, and they no longer would have to face a requirement to be classified as hourly workers. So they could stand to lose their overtime.
I would think that although the corporations who are backing this rules change by the White House, they certainly are contributing lots of money to the Republicans for this, but I would think that this rules change has an Achilles heel in that you have millions of workers potentially who are going to lose large amounts of income due to its implementation, and therefore there's going to be some outrage out there when it filters down to somebody's weekly check.
There does seem to be a lack of that type of calculus on the part of the administration, but you could say the same thing about these tax cuts. I mean, these tax cuts were heavily tilted towards the wealthy, and in fact, the most recent tax cut left behind, probably about a fifth of all working families who, since they don't face a federal tax liability, got nothing at all from the tax cut. So, you know, the administration is clearly throwing the dice and figuring, well, we don't need these constituents to vote for us. We should remember that if we're right on our prediction, we're talking about 8 million people who would lose their overtime protection. Now, that's a lot of people, especially in a close election, but it still represents a small fraction of the workforce. Once you look at the language and you try to parse it out, it really does seem to be lowering the bar for the ability of employers to classify workers as salaried and thus not pay them any more overtime pay.
That was Jared Bernstein, senior economist with Economic Policy Institute. To contact the group, call area code 202-775-8810 or visit their website at www.epinet.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Toff. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer-Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.